This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Albert Einstein was asked if he believed in God, the great 20th century scientist reached back to a 17th century philosopher for an answer. "I believe," said Einstein, "in Spinoza's God." Baruch Spinoza was the brilliant outcast heretic who broke open the doors to modern thought with his assertion that God is essentially nature, no more and no less. His great philosophical adversary, the glittering Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, defender of the old transcendent God. They met, they fought, and the fight goes on today in the dance of humanism and faith. Up next on Point, philosophy as page-turner, Leibniz, Spinoza, and a new telling of the fate of God in the modern world. Joining me now from Santa Barbara, California, is Matthew Stewart, himself a doctor of philosophy and a big money management consultant who cashed out to live the life of contemplation. He's the author of the new book, The Courtier and the Heretic, Leibniz, Spinoza, and the Fate of God in the Modern World. It's a kind of Da Vinci Code dramatization of high philosophy. Matthew Stewart, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Delighted to be here.
And if you'd be good enough, I wish you'd just open straight up with a reading from the opening pages of the book that sort of places us here. Would you mind jumping straight into the top of the book and give us a flavor?
Yes, Tom, I will. Here we go. It is our good fortune to live in an age when philosophy is thought to be a harmless affair. As the autumn of 1676 approached, however, Baruch de Spinoza had ample reason to fear for his safety. One of his friends had recently been executed, and another had died in prison. His efforts to publish his definitive work, The Ethics, had come to end amid threats of criminal prosecution. A leading French theologian named him the most impious and the most dangerous man of the century. A powerful bishop denounced him as that insane and evil man who deserves to be covered with chains and whipped with a rod. To the general public, he was known simply as the atheist Jew. Among those who seemed eager to bring the infidel philosopher to justice was a young courtier and polymath named Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. In a personal letter to that same French theologian, Leibniz described Spinoza's work as horrible and terrifying. To a famous professor, he called it intolerably impudent. To a friend, he confided, "I deplore that a man of such evident culture should have fallen so low." Yet in the privacy of his study, Leibniz crammed his notebooks with meticulous commentaries on Spinoza's writings. He exchanged secret letters with his public nemesis, addressing him as celebrated doctor and profound philosopher. Through mutual friends, he pleaded for a chance to examine a manuscript copy of the Ethics. And, on or around November 18, 1676, he traveled to The Hague and called on Spinoza in person.
There we have it, Matthew Stewart, reading from the very beginning of his fascinating new book, The Courtier and the Heretic, Leibniz, Spinoza, and the Fate of God in the Modern World, setting up just how dangerous it was to be a Spinoza at that time, and how a big intellectual like Leibniz was pushing back. Matthew Stewart, we're going to bring all of this up to date, but take us back to begin with, to the 17th century, and what was breaking out in the relationship between these two schools of thought, and in a way between these two men? What was the new thought dawning here?
Well, in order to set the stage, you really have to go back to the 16th century and the Reformation. So Western Europe and Western thinking changed dramatically during that period, and all of a sudden there were all these new religious sects, there were new varieties of religious experience, and an increasing diversity in society. At the same time, you had the breakthrough of modern science. You had Galileo in the early 17th century, and later on Newton. So you had huge changes in society, breakthroughs in science. And all of these led to major changes in the way people thought about the world. And the crux of that was how they thought about scriptures, how they thought about the main concepts of religion. And Spinoza and Leibniz were taking two very different tacks on that.
You say it led many people to change the way they thought about the world, but Baruch Spinoza was going much further than the mainstream. You say that he helped really establish the modern liberal secular world, the world that the American Constitution grew out of. What was Spinoza's breakthrough?
It's interesting when you summarize Spinoza's thought in a certain way. It sounds kind of anodyne. It sounds really obvious to a lot of people today. But you have to remember that in those times it was quite radical. If there's a core to it, I would say, that's especially relevant now, it's this idea of freedom of conscience, the idea that that is the foundation of a society, that everyone has a kind of natural right to think what they want to think, to believe what they want to believe, and that the purpose of the state is to protect that right. That's the crux of it. He also argued that that resulted in a better, more vibrant society. These things sound kind of obvious to us now, but at the time it was radical and it got him into lots of trouble.
And he pursued his freedom of conscience to a definition of God that was quite at odds with the medieval or Renaissance notion.
Yes, that's right. The core of it there has to do with science and the understanding of nature. What happened in the 16th and 17th centuries was that people began to see that science could eventually explain an awful lot, that miracles would ultimately be dissolved into just ignorance. You know, that what seems to be a miracle, in fact, once we know more, just turns out to be a very kind of fascinating, complex, natural phenomenon. So he saw where that was going. And his he saw that that would basically put the kind of the Old Testament God out of business. And so he conceived of a new kind, or in a way he resurrected an old concept of God when he said that God is nature, that the entire world around us is a manifestation of a certain core essence, and that essence is nothing other than God.
So these days, when we're told that science can increasingly explain even the most intimate human activities of the mind and memory and comprehension of the world, Spinoza's right in the middle of that. He's saying, yes, in a way, God is nature, almost God is science.
Yes, that's right. I mean, he is very much in the middle, very much anticipating where it's going. I think, though, you have to be careful to avoid pigeonholing him as some kind of reductivist, someone who says, well, it just all boils down to a few simple forces which only scientists understand. In Spinoza, as in a lot of sophisticated thinkers along these lines, you don't have that kind of reductionism. But you do have this sense that what's really special about the world is, in fact, the natural phenomena. They are terrifically complex, but the more we understand them, the more we understand God. That's the way Spinoza would put it.
In the pushback from that 17th century society, from Leibniz in particular, was?
There are a lot of reasons Leibniz had to push back, but one that I think people will probably relate to today is this. He thought that people couldn't survive, couldn't be moral without some of that good old-fashioned religion. I mean, he's sort of subscribed to the view that in a way, you could say that people are inherently wicked until they're kind of conditioned by holy books not to be. So that's in a sense the core of it. He thought basically society would fall apart without a belief in some sort of traditional deity and some sort of traditional sources of revelation.
And Leibniz's God was not just nature; it was a transcendent God who could kind of pull strings and direct human life.
Well, what's especially fascinating about Leibniz's conception of God with respect to Spinoza is that on the one hand, Leibniz did see that Spinoza had a certain point. Leibniz couldn't go back to the old-fashioned, God in the thundercloud who sort of arbitrarily shows up on the scene and wreaks a few miracles. Leibniz wanted a God that was consistent with science. But at the same time, he also took the view that Spinoza's type of God ultimately doesn't do anything that's good or bad. Spinoza's God just creates the world as it is without a view towards making it particularly good or bad and without loving mankind or anything like that. So Leibniz took the view that God, in fact, chooses the best of all possible worlds and, so he is good even if what he ultimately produces is something like a scientific or clockwork universe.
Ultimately mocked for that view by Voltaire, who cast him much later as the Pangloss in Candide. Jack Beattie's been listening in, though we haven't been able to hear you, Jack, but there you are. Here's Matthew Stewart telling quite a story in a very dramatic fashion. What do you see at the heart of it, Jack?
Well, I connect with here, Matthew, is the way you talk about Spinoza's political commitments as, in some sense, prior and conditioning philosophy. And at the center of those political commitments really was the idea of liberalism, that is, of self-rule, that we do not need divine right of kings, that we can choose our own government, that people can govern themselves. And at the center of that was his attack or dismissal, really, of superstition. I mean, of the anthropomorphic God, he writes, if a triangle could speak, it would say that God is eminently triangular. Hence, human beings see God as a human being. But he wanted to get especially at this idea of the immortality of the soul.
Let's take a call. Michael's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'd say that Spinoza's stock is still high among people who do scientific work or any other sort of rationalist inquiry into the universe, but I'm afraid Leibniz's stock is rising overall. Leibniz's God, no matter how domesticated in some ways, still is incompatible with actually doing science, because in scientific work, a lot of the interesting stuff comes when you investigate an anomaly. And if you always have the option of throwing up your hand and saying, well, God changed the dial while I wasn't looking,
right,
then the inquiry is over. And it's not very far from there to God put the fossils in the earth to test the faithful. So you have to have a completely naturalistic universe in order to do reasonable scientific work. Leibniz's God stock is rising because of what used to be called future shock, and lots of people coming in from the countryside all over the world into the cities and living very badly. And in situations like that, people seem to need a big daddy in the sky.
And maybe it's still there to reach for. Michael, thanks for your call. Matthew Stewart, what about it? All the way back at this fateful meeting that you describe in 1676, did these two philosophers see their opposing visions? And Grant, you describe some of Leibniz's sympathy, secret sympathy for Spinoza, but lots of opposition here. Did they see it as a philosophical death match, that one view of the world, the cosmos, had to die for the other to live?
Yes, Leibniz certainly saw it that way. He wrote in certain passages that he thought the world was essentially going to go through a horrible revolution, that Spinoza's ideas were slithering like, you know, evil serpents throughout society and were going to result in this great turmoil. So there was this deep struggle. I think there is one important distinction to make here, though. Leibniz wasn't what you'd call a fundamentalist. So the people who opposed Spinoza, you could really divide them into two camps. One is the sort of medieval fundamentalists who, you know, just take out their Bibles and, you know, hold that up to Spinoza and say, you're wrong and this is right. The other camp is like Leibniz, and if you want a modern analogy to that, I would say it's something more like the intelligent design world. These are people who, yes, are understand that modernity isn't going to go away, understand that science does produce some valuable results, but they're still looking for some kind of compromise, and they're still holding out hope that, once science is over with, then we have our beautiful religion to fall back on. And that more accurately describes Leibniz. I'm not going to disagree with Michael at all. The only thing I would say is that that's certainly not going to go away. I mean, that's this kind of what I call reactive mentality that Leibniz instantiates. That's, to me, seems to be so ingrained in human nature that it's going to be there, and we should learn to understand it and deal with it.
You make much in your book, in your dramatic telling of this moment in 1676 when Leibniz visits Spinoza. Spinoza kind of banished to the edge of town, out where the city gives way to the famous windmills of that countryside. And they sit down, in your telling at least, and have a big conversation about this meeting of two continents of thought. As you look at them throughout the whole book, you convey to us, and explicitly, that character is philosophy, the character and background of these two men coming to the fore in their philosophy. Tell us about these two philosophers. When they met in 1676, who were they? What are the paths they'd been on?
Yes, very interesting. Just a couple points on the meeting, though, I think are really worth bringing out. One is that the most important thing is just the fact that it took place. Because Spinoza was such an outcast, visiting him was dangerous, because Leibniz had put himself on record saying he thought Spinoza was horrible and terrifying, it's extraordinary that Leibniz took the effort to go see him. And I think that that says an awful lot about Leibniz's thought. And then the other thing is that I think, and some scholars will disagree with me on this, but I think that Leibniz's thought changes quite dramatically and significantly in the few years after that meeting, which I think it's reasonable to attribute to the meeting itself.
Because a seed of doubt planted there by Spinoza in his second-floor apartment?
It's not what you think, in a way. Mm-hmm. Leibniz went there actually more open to Spinoza than when he left. And I think that what happened is that before going, Leibniz probably was holding out some hope that Spinoza could help articulate a new concept of God that would work in the modern world and that would maybe preserve some of the old ideas as well. And that when he got there and had the debate with Spinoza, he probably got put in his place and came to understand that at a deep level there was no compromise. And that at a deep level, the thinking that was leading him, Leibniz, towards this Spinozist idea of God was actually leading him towards atheism, believe it or not. And so Leibniz, in a way, was the paradox that runs through the story is that Leibniz is, in a way, a lot closer to atheism than Spinoza is, because in Spinoza you have no doubt whatsoever that God is nature. But in the case of Leibniz, you know, there are all these proofs and so on that in the end that seem to kind of vanish under the weight of his own arguments, and so you're kind of left wondering what he really did believe.
If it's not the old-fashioned God, it's nothing. Now, he was the relative dandy coming here. This is a man not at all the aesthetic like Spinoza. He was a kind of a intellectual power climber.
Yes, and you mentioned the subject of character and philosophy, and this for me is something very important. I think we have an idea today that a person who does philosophy isn't necessarily an academic, and so probably walks around wearing, you know, tweed jackets and, you know, the
pipe
beard
smoke
and bald and glasses, whatever, something like that. That just wasn't the case historically. Neither Spinoza nor Leibniz was a professor, and they were radically different. Leibniz showed up as a courtier. He was a power-hungry, ambitious political thinker and operator. He met with Louis XIV's key people. He advocated in sort of good neocon fashion an invasion of the Middle East as a way of solving Europe's problems.
Into Egypt.
into Egypt, indeed, when Napoleon 100 years later took him up on the idea. But he was a truly political person, and he dressed the part. He dressed like one of those characters in Dangerous Liaisons, whereas Spinoza was a humble lens grinder. He had been kicked out of his community in Amsterdam, the small Jewish community in Amsterdam. He lived on his own in rented rooms, wore plain clothes, and dedicated himself to pure thinking. So they were radically different in character and circumstances, and that just shows through over and over again in their philosophies.
You describe the day, as you imagine it at least, the rattling window panes and the creaky floorboards, the smell of soup, the very humble circumstances of the outcast Spinoza. And how do you picture the exchange that took place between these two men, Matthew Stewart?
Well, I do want to say, for those who believe in truth and nonfiction, that I think I do mark quite clearly what I'm just sort of imagining and what we have evidence for.
Fully labeled, fully noted.
Fully labeled and fully noted. What we do have evidence for is that the two did have a metaphysical discussion. There is one sheet of paper that was actually written during the course of the meeting, and it was in Leibniz's hand, and it was a proof of the existence of God, or actually more specifically a proof of the possibility of a certain concept of God from which would eventually follow God's existence. It was Leibniz's proof, and then he wrote at the bottom of the page an interesting little note. He said, when I first presented this argument to Spinoza verbally, Spinoza rejected it. So I wrote it down, read it out to him, and then he approved. For me, that's almost perfect picture of the character of the two men in action. Leibniz was, I think it's fair to say, extraordinarily vain. He was probably the smartest person alive at the time by any whatever measure you can come up with. I mean, this is the man who invented the calculus, who mastered dozens of different kinds of fields, and he knew he was smart, and he could not stand to lose an argument. So it doesn't surprise me in the least that he would have, you know, once getting rejected by Spinoza on this argument, turned around, written it down, and read it out and demanded approval.
You cannot disagree, but Spinoza would be arguing what in return?
You see, Leibniz's concept of God there was, I think, deeply divided or deeply confused. If you read it one way, the definition of God he offers is very much like that Spinoza offers. And in fact, Leibniz had been reading Spinoza before coming to the meeting. So if you read the proof one way, it sounds like he's proving to Spinoza the existence of Spinoza's God, to which, of course, Spinoza would undoubtedly say, well, good for you. I think you're right. On the other hand, it's quite clear that Leibniz went to this meeting with some of his traditional theocratic commitments intact. And he somehow thought that the God whose existence he was trying to prove was compatible with this old theocratic order. So Leibniz, in a sense, wasn't clear about what he was proving to Spinoza. It seems to me a reasonable conjecture based on what Spinoza said about similar concepts of God, that is, he entertained Leibnizian-style ideas of God. It seems reasonable to conclude that Spinoza would have first heard Leibniz's traditional ideas of God and just said, no, you're wrong, young man. Spinoza was, I think, this kind of, you know, eminently self-convinced philosopher. And then, you know, on hearing Leibniz sort of put it into words, said, well, if you understand it in this way, i.e. in my way, then perhaps you're right. But my argument then is if you look at what Leibniz wrote afterwards, he himself then became clear on Spinoza's message, which was if the God you're talking about is my nature God, good, and if not, you know, that God doesn't exist.
And off he went with stop Spinoza as his kind of dictate, imperative for the rest of his life. Jack Beattie, that unresolved conversation there in the countryside of the Netherlands, still unresolved today. It sounds so familiar.
Yes, and, you know, our caller Michael brings out the sort of a popular or, you know, popular reaction against modernity, the almost a willful celebration of superstition and so on. But as you point out, Mr. Stewart, this is also in philosophy. In some ways, Leibniz won the argument because the irrational and the inexplicable, the noumenal, whatever you want to call it, that which reason cannot know, has had a real career in philosophy ever since. And there's been a rebellion against science and against that claustral world within philosophy, too.
Matthew Stewart, Leibniz as the ultimate winner here?
He's I think, the winner in terms of numbers. But frankly, he's not the winner in terms of the truth or logic of the arguments. That's the paradox that we're faced with. And yes, I do want to point out that much of what we call philosophy now is really just this kind of reactive, pseudo-religious thinking that is attempting to kind of cover up some of the unwanted truths and insights put forward by science and put forward by more rigorous thinking philosophers like Spinoza.
Let us turn to our listeners. A lot are looking to join here. Bill's calling from Bordentown, New Jersey. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
We're good. What do you think, Bill?
I'd fall down on the side of Spinoza. Actually, I'm a Wiccan, and I would like to ask my question would be, what does your guest think about this debate still being alive and well? I mean, there are millions of people that are going to celebrate today as a Sabbath being the solstice. And I was just curious how they feel about that, about the debate.
The start of spring. So, Bill, you're a Wiccan. That means kind of a pagan, what, nature worshiper.
Exactly. Exactly right down in line with what Spinoza was trying to explain.
Well, I don't know if Spinoza would see it that way or not, but let's get Matthew Stewart to respond. Mr. Stewart.
Yes. Look, I don't think that Spinoza would be endorsing some kind of pagan nature worship. No. I mean, he was you know, fundamentally what you'd call loosely a rationalist or a science-minded philosopher. And he would say that probably that kind of pagan nature worship is not really different from traditional religion in that it imagines all sorts of agency or ends being pursued in nature that simply aren't there. I mean, in his view, nature is fundamentally a series of efficient causes, not a series of final causes or things operating towards some particular purpose. And that to imagine otherwise is to sort of let the human imagination get carried away. I mean, it's just superstition. So, no, I'm sorry if Spinoza won't be endorsing that position. But you know, on the other hand, clearly that when Spinoza says that God is nature, there is you know, some sense of worship toward the you know, the world we see around us, that is a sense that this is all the unfolding of some deeper essence. So perhaps in a very abstract way, there's a connection.
And Matthew Stewart, the line you draw from Spinoza to, let's say, the thinking of the founding fathers in the United States, the Enlightenment thinking that led to the fundamental conception behind the U.S. Constitution and the American project. How do you see Spinoza's fingerprints there?
I would say there are three things that are really important to bear in mind. One is this idea of freedom of conscience, and this also addresses some of the religious debate that we're talking about. Spinoza does say that, you know, to have a functioning society, people have to have their natural rights. And one of these natural rights is to think for yourself and to form your own conclusions. So even though he may have his own particular views about God and nature, he certainly wouldn't be the kind who would insist that everyone else has to agree with this particular view. But he would say that you have to build a society around the idea of freedom of conscience, or that, you know, the purpose of the state is basically to maintain freedom. And I think that kind of goes without saying as part of the United States Constitution. A second point is that he saw that the purpose of government is basically to serve people. It's not to manifest divine will on earth. It doesn't reflect some kind of arbitrary heritage. It is basically the legitimacy of government derives from the consent of the governed. And our Constitution begins with we the people. I think that you can trace that directly there. And then the final thing, perhaps links up more closely to the Declaration of Independence. Spinoza differs from Hobbes, for example, in saying that government can, in fact, overstep its bounds. It can violate the rights of the people. And at a certain point, the people have a right to revolt. That right is what was invoked in the Declaration of Independence.
And there's our man Spinoza flowing right down through the years. Henry's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Henry. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. Nice to be here.
Sure. Good.
It sounds like a fascinating book. I just think you have to be wary of kind of simplistic dichotomies between science and faith, or between progress and traditionalism. I mean, if you take, for example, this idea of the eternal soul, and you look at someone like Roger Williams, who is also a figure in freedom of conscience and thought, His whole basis for that was the eternity of the soul, and the distinction between the spirit and nature was what sort of grounded a person's moral freedom and the freedom of conscience, which he called soul liberty. Mm-hmm. And if you look at science today, it's very different from the science of the 16th or 17th century. If you look at Einstein or Hermann Gödel or quantum theory, a lot of questions about the determinism in scientific explanation or causation have been brought into question by science itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, the limits to what we can say or describe in math or physics.
Henry, hold that thought if you would. I want to get Matthew Stewart in. And Matthew, can you channel a little Spinoza for us in response to Henry's observations here?
Yeah, thanks, Henry. There are a couple of very interesting points here to discuss. One is that it's absolutely true that you can find a basis in some religious thought for arguments in favor of freedom of conscience. There's no doubt, for example, that it was Baptists who helped Thomas Jefferson in Virginia get his ideas for religious freedom in put on the books there. So there's no question that there's a lot of complexity in, you know, who supports and why they support ideas like freedom of conscience or religious liberty. More generally, I think Henry's point's absolutely right that you've got to avoid simple dichotomies, and I think that Spinoza is an excellent case in point. Today we take for granted that anybody who talks about politics in the quite secular way that he does must therefore set aside any discussion of God whatsoever. But actually, Spinoza spent the first third of his magnum opus proving the existence of God. So you can't apply any simple dichotomy there and just say flat out he was a radical atheist, because there's complexity to it. Maybe he was in some certain way, or he certainly rejected a certain concept of deity. But you can't just say flat out that he was what we'd think of today as a secular person. End of story.
Matthew, sir, draw that distinction for us. While we've got Henry here, he saw God as nature, but he didn't see that view as atheism. So, how did he see God in nature without atheism?
Well, he's offering a different idea of God. And today we tend to allow people to define God as they want. And so today I think Spinoza would have to count as, let's say, a theist, or someone who believes in some sort of abstract philosophical idea of God.
But what was the theistic element? If he saw it as nature, we're now accustomed to seeing nature in deep dimension as an expression of science. But when he saw it, there's still a theist at work there. What was the theistic point that he saw?
That is a very, very good question, because Leibniz basically argued that there was no theistic element. He just essentially got rid of God and put nature in its place. So it's a really important question, and there's no easy answer to it. But Spinoza clearly did think that he could identify these two, and his argument was that what you've got in nature is something that is all-powerful, that determines everything. And that is, he thought, that's what we mean by God, basically, this sort of entity that exists in and through itself, that is what it is and is, you know, whatever it wants to be. And so he said that's what God is. It's this thing we call nature. I think we also have to remember that when Spinoza said nature, he was thinking in kind of logical terms rather than in terms of birds and bees. He was thinking in terms of the essence of things. So, you know, coffee has a nature, and the laws of physics represent a certain nature. And his nature, with a capital N, was a kind of generalization over all of these essential natures. It was sort of the essence of the world. Now, whether that's God or not, well, that's kind of up to you and the reader. I just report the facts.
Henry, you're suggesting that there's not a built-in contradiction here, but Leibniz certainly felt one.
Well, I mean, I think there is a difference between a kind of pantheism and different versions of religious theism. But listening to your author, I mean, it sounds like if you think of the concept of truth, and maybe God is connected with or identical with truth, then if the searcher gets to the truth of nature, then he'll also discover the truth about God. So, I mean, maybe that's kind of what Spinoza was aiming at.
Of course,
I'm just guessing.
Yeah, we got it, Henry. Thanks for your call. Jack Beattie, when you put the truth framing around this, truth can be defined in many ways too, and faith quickly comes in.
Yes, if that's the end of science, to find the nature of things, and when you find them, that's God, because it's true. There is something appealing about that. I can imagine the theist saying, "But wait a minute, that's the God of the philosophers. What about the God who's interested in me? What about the God of love? What about Jesus? What about all that? Doesn't that mean more? Don't I have to have that in my life?" And I could see in that way the theism of Spinoza can seem like it can seem as thin as the gruel he ate as his primary nourishment.
The ascetic Spinoza. Christy's calling from Maynard, Massachusetts. Hi, Christy, you're on the air.
Hi. My point is, listening to people calling in and listening to this argument a lot, first of all, I'm an atheist.
Okay.
And for 40 years, I tried to figure out what was wrong with me, because I couldn't marry the two concepts together.
Which two exactly?
The idea that there is this supernatural power that was caring and loving, and I just had to take it on faith, and the science of demanding evidence.
Does Spinoza show you a way? Albert Einstein grabbed onto the Spinoza idea. Nature is God.
Well, yeah. I mean, I could say nature is God. But when I say nature is God, people interpret the word God as somebody who has a plan for me and a purpose, and there's a purpose in my life, when in fact I believe that there is no purpose other than, you know, self-replication and evolution. But I always felt like people did a disservice to me saying, well, there is no contradiction, when in fact faith means the exact opposite of demanding evidence. You believe in something because there's no evidence. And my point is just that when people say there doesn't have to be a contradiction, it makes those of us who can't resolve the conflict feel like there's something wrong with us. And, right. You know?
Yeah, I understand. I want to put it to Matthew Stewart. Matthew, there's a great temptation, longing to say there's no contradiction, because if there is a contradiction, it's almost overwhelming the amount of conflict that sits in that today. Christy looks at it and says, wait a minute, where's that leave me, the atheist here? Contradiction or not?
Absolutely, there's a contradiction. But I want to recommend that Christy take another look at Spinoza for a slightly different but related reason. Spinoza doesn't just say that there's no evidence for this alternative, you know, traditional religious view. He says that it's actually kind of bad for you. He says that emotionally, that it leads to a emotional confusion, that it makes us subject to all of these passions. If we allow ourselves to be guided by what he calls the imagination, which is, you know, this thing in our mind that creates all these ideas based on insufficient evidence and so on, then we fail to fulfill ourselves. So it's not just a question of you defending yourself against these other people who have something that you know they say is good and you don't have. You know, you can turn the tables on them in that respect with Spinoza. But going back to the question of contradiction, well, yes, I mean, I think that, you know, you either think that there is some kind of entity out there that has a positive design for you, or you don't. I mean, I don't see how you can try to compromise too much on that. I think Leibniz did actually try to compromise to some degree, but, you know, compromise in philosophy usually leads to being made fun of.
And so off he went, disconcerted from his meeting with Spinoza. Christy, thanks for your call. Darian is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Darian. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you know?
Well, I think that both of these philosophies can exist because they both have truths part, you know, truths to them. And I'd just like to say, when you look at objectivity versus subjectivity, the objective would be science. And if God is nature, which is logical to me as a scientist, then when you look at that and say, well, I am also a part of nature, then the whole subjectivity realm comes in because I have a consciousness. You know, I have my own self-conscious as part of the objective world of nature. I also exist.
So does that mean that anything that pops into your mind because of your consciousness is part of nature is as valid as a rock or a tree or an isosceles triangle?
No, exactly not, because there's such thing as shared subjective views or collective truths. And so if you have a system of tradition that is a shared collective truth, such as, you know, what Leibniz would say, that does contradict natural truth if it's not collectively held.
Let me put it to Matthew Stewart. Matthew, you can hear so many callers looking to bridge this gap. Are you going to give Darian that?
No, I'm not. I'm not going to. I mean, I get kind of lost when I hear things like shared collective truth, and then that contradicts some kind of natural truth. I don't think you have to be some sort of dogmatic rationalist to think that you can't have those two things in the same room. I mean, either the shared collective thing is true in some sense that we can accept, or it's not.
I want to ask you, if I may, Matthew Stewart, about your own path to this. You studied political philosophy at Princeton. You studied, got a doctorate in philosophy at Oxford. You went off into business because you didn't like the way academic philosophy was turned out, and you happened to make a lot of money in business and management consulting, and have come back now to the life of contemplation. You describe philosophy as being a dangerous undertaking in Spinoza's era. How do you see it today? Is serious philosophy a dangerous undertaking today, or are we now comfortable juggling lots of different seriously held views at once, or not?
Well, I think it's dangerous if you are in Iran or in most of the Middle East, for example. And I look forward to seeing Spinoza's arising from that part of the world. And I think that it's also, you know, it's increasingly a little bit difficult in the United States. I mean, we do have this emerging, what I think is basically a theocratic movement, which, to the extent that they have more success, will increasingly make it dangerous to be a free thinker. I mean, of course, that's something of an exaggeration, because after all, here we are on the radio talking as we wish. So I don't want to, you know, make
Amen.
It too dramatic. But, you know, it's definitely something that's an issue that's on the horizon that we have to bear in mind.
And what about, you give a nod, a tip of the hat to Copenhagen, the play where Heisenberg and Niels Bohr talk about the bomb. Has the Spinoza-Leibniz dialogue, as a philosopher, how do you has it evolved? I mean, do we have insights that they didn't hold in that little Dutch second-floor room in 1676?
You know, this is one of the reasons why I decided that academic philosophy wasn't going to be for me is that there was this idea that has been all this progress in philosophy, and that, you know, after several centuries of effort, we know a lot more. We have all these sophisticated arguments and so on. I just don't accept that. I mean, when I see the just as a matter of observation, I'm not saying this dogmatically. When I look at the debates that they were having, sure, the terms are very different, but when I compare them to what goes on now in contemporary debates, I don't see any significant improvement in the sense of progress. I see a change in terms. I see shift in emphasis. There's obviously a huge difference in the background circumstances, but the philosophy is not the kind of thing that fundamentally advances, in my view.
Jack Beattie, here we are on the horns of this debate all these centuries later, and Matthew Stewart says, get used to it.
Get used to it, but strangely enough, not from philosophy. It's been professionalized. And the clash that people feel in the culture in many ways doesn't get represented in the philosophy class. I remember my disappointment on finding that out, that philosophy as studied tends to be inert and unconnected to the kinds of things that these people were dealing with.
Matthew Stewart, we just got you for another minute here. Describe these two men's end. Spinoza, did he die a happy man? What about Leibniz?
Well, Spinoza died at 44 of tuberculosis, which arguably was aggravated by his lens grinding work. Mm-hmm. So from a health point of view, sad. But from a personal point of view, it does seem that he found some equanimity, that he had a kind of happiness, at least one hopes so, because that's what his main book was about. Leibniz lived a long life, worked as a courtier, but in the end he was so political that he finally ended up on the wrong side, sort of left to languish in Hanover, while his master, Georg Ludwig, went over to England to claim the throne there. So not a very happy ending for Leibniz.
And then to be mocked in death by Voltaire as Dr. Pangloss. Matthew Stewart, it's an absolutely fascinating story, and you tell it extraordinarily well. We're delighted to have you back in the world of philosophy. Welcome back, and we hope you'll do it again.
Thank you, Tom.
Matthew Stewart's new book is The Courtier and the Heretic, Leibniz, Spinoza, and the Fate of God in the Modern World. Jack Beattie, great to have you along. Thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, and subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakravarti, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Vince Fairchild and Matt Odette, our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.